You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm Jay Taylor, your host, and I'm really happy to have Alistair McLeod with me once again. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
It's really good to have you, and we need to tell everybody that they should go every Thursday to goldmoney.com to read your latest missives, because they really are full of insights. If people really care to understand why things are happening the way they are, and not be satisfied with the superficial explanations you get on CNBC and elsewhere, then I would suggest you read what Alistair has to say at goldmoney.com. Alistair, I'd like today to talk to you, or have you talk to us, I should say, about inflation, deflation, and other fallacies. You wrote that article on September 10th, and then China is killing the dollar. That was September 17th. Starting with your September 10th article, I'd like to ask you to explain some of the conventional wisdom that we hear every day in the financial medium that are essentially fallacies. You note that the most egregious of these fallacies is that inflation can only occur as the handmaiden of economic growth, while deflation is similarly linked to a recession spinning out of control into the maelstrom of a slump. And end of quote. And I would say this may certainly be the most egregious fallacies, but it is one of the most, I think, one of the most believed doctrines of the Keynesian religion. And so, you know, most people see inflation as a positive thing. They think that's really good because it shows that we're starting to stimulate growth. Money is pumped into the system, so the demand side starts to pick up. And so they're actually looking for inflation as a sign that they're doing good work. But can you explain why this idea, taken as gospel truth, is a falsehood?
Yes, sure. I mean, if it was really true that we want to pay high prices for goods, then we wouldn't go to the supermarket and look at the shelves for the things that are sort of, you know, buy one, get one free, or 20% off, or whatever. I mean, it's complete nonsense. I mean, the idea basically seems to be, at least this is the story, that if, let us say, we think that prices of things are going to be higher tomorrow, then we will hurry up and buy them today, and that way bring demand forward. But I mean, that's a load of rubbish. That only applies in a situation, really, where inflation is actually running at such a rate that is demonstrably true. But for, you know, under normal circumstances, we know that the rate of inflation, price inflation in America is running at about 10%. Forget what the CPI says. We know that's a load of rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
It's running about 10%. But, you know, does that mean we sort of rush out and actually sort of think, oh, I must buy things before it goes up by 0.001% day to day? No, it doesn't. I mean, it's a complete nonsense. The reason that the macroeconomist push the inflation story is actually quite simple, and that is to allow them to print money as part of government funding. And also, by printing money and lowering interest rates, they lower the cost of government borrowing. So that is your real reason. The sort of economic conditions that really suit ordinary people like you and me are essentially mildly deflationary. Now, what I mean by that is that competition with sound money drives down prices over time. So I looked at sort of approximate prices between about 1820 and before the First World War. And I would say the general price level fell to roughly 0.4% of what it was before. Now, this is a difficult thing over a long period of time because, you can't really compare one set of goods with another set of goods simply because people are doing different things. I mean, at the start of that period, there was a lot of subsistence living. Ordinary people just basically made enough or grew enough in order to survive, and maybe just a tiny bit left over to clothe themselves and heat themselves. Not much more than that. But towards the end of the Industrial Revolution, of course, there was very widespread prosperity. I mean, okay, we hear all the Dickensian stories about workhouses and all the rest of it, but that was actually just, you know, a very small part of the economy. And, you know, quite honestly, I think a modern economy has probably got more misfits, unemployed, however you like, spongers, however you like to define it, because the state will provide. But, you know, the natural condition is that through competition, prices basically decline over time. And that leads us to another thing, because if you have sound money, in other words, there is no increase in the quantity of money in the economy, then as prices fall, guess what? GDP falls. Now, that's meant to be a very bad thing. You could look at it another way, and that is with inflation. If you just pump the GDP figure full of false money, then your GDP number rises. And that actually is the basis of the fallacy behind it all. This is why nobody questions it.
Yeah. So the incentive of government to borrow and to I suppose to buy votes or to spend money that they can be involved with somehow enriching themselves. I mean, we see the military-industrial complex. Washington in the United States has grown to be such a monstrous. I mean, all of these different bureaucracies are just absolutely huge budgets, and there are people living high on the hog around Washington. I mean, one of the wealthiest areas in the country is around Washington, D.C., because all of these people that are involved in government and government handouts and so forth. So I guess that's the incentive, though you certainly wouldn't get that if you in your Economics 101 course, your Keynesian course, would you, at the university? They wouldn't tell you that's the reason you do it. So people really do believe these fallacies. There's others that you talk about as well here. You're a little bit hard on supply-siders and demand-siders. Why are they both wrong-minded? I mean, we have the Republicans here that tend to be supply-siders, Larry Kudlow, for example, and some of the others. And you have the Democrats, which, of course, are full-fledged Keynesians. They want to spend and print money and so forth to pay for it. They're both wrong. I mean, they're both. You're saying they're both policies are lead down the wrong path.
Well, yes, because whether a government is trying to drive demand or whether they're trying to drive supply, I mean, basically what they're doing is they're interfering in the economy. The supply side, you know, driving the supply side is probably, you know, sort of slightly better, if you like, than trying to drive demand, because demand is driven, you know, purely by the inflation story that we've just been talking about. And of course, that actually ends up transferring wealth from people to the state. Supply-siders, the idea behind supply-side is that government subsidizes business, which is, you know, in one sense is not too much of a sin, but it subsidizes business at the expense of everybody else, because you end up with a larger budget deficit, and unless savings increase to fund that deficit, that deficit is funded through inflation. So and with supply side, if you've got an awful lot of time, you can probably create a case that you know, you start off with a higher budget deficit, but the taxes will roll in later. The point behind it is it's all about taxes. It's all about getting taxes in. From the government's point of view, they will only go down the supply side route if they believe at the end of the day that they will get more tax as a result. And indeed, they openly recommend it on that basis. So, you know, this is why I don't really hold too much truck for either of those parties.
Yeah, well, it seems that's all they know to do, or all they really want to do, because I guess if you were to roll things back now, this is a problem. If you were to try to go back and reduce government spending, the pain would be very great. And so from getting from where we are now to a more ideal situation, if people would even recognize that as being ideal, you know, the Mises, the free market people understand it, but obviously it's not in the mindset of most university graduates, so... the established order, then, of course, doesn't believe that They don't believe that the established order doesn't believe prices can rise in a falling economy, right? So they think that the only way prices can rise is if prices are, you know, if the economy is booming.
Yeah.
But in fact, you just pointed out during the Industrial Revolution, the opposite was true.
Well, the reason that you get the reason you get greater inflation when an economy is contracting is because both production and consumption, you know, we're both producers and consumers, and mm-hmm. that happens for every, you know, in every state of the economy. So if you have a situation where you've got expanding production and expanding employment and you've got sound money, then you can get falling prices. I think we've gone through that. But the yeah. other side, the other aspect of this is that if you get an economy which is in distress, going down, as it were, then it's not just demand that goes down, which if it was just demand, it would lead to lower prices. But also because everybody who demands as a consumer is also a producer, unless he's unemployed, of mm-hmm. course. Mm-hmm. But one way or the other, you know, the two things are just tied together. And, of course, Say's Law tells us that this is the case. And guess what? The first thing that the macroeconomic community did was deny the validity of Say's Law. So they're not going to get the right answer anyway. It's as simple as that.
Well, there seems to be almost no concern now that, it seems to be taken as a given by the establishment, by the mainstream press anyway, that interest rates are going to stay low forever. They can't rise. You have a different view of that, I think. And tell us how Mother Nature might go to work to make that not true, that the powers that be can no longer force rates to some negative level or whatever level they want.
Right. Well, we have a situation at the moment where the government is financing itself through inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the idea that the Fed is independent and all the rest of it. I mean, the fact is the government is financing itself through monetary inflation. The effect of that is to drive down the purchasing power of the dollar. Now, it doesn't happen sort of, evenly, but what can happen, and this is something that people don't appreciate, is that a relatively small amount of increase in the quantity of dollars can actually drive the price, the purchasing power of the dollar down quite sharply. And this was certainly, I was looking actually at the situation in Germany for a current article, which I'm working on, mm-hmm. In 1923. And there was a period in Germany where amount of paper mark circulation increased by something like 28 times, but the price effect was to increase the quantity of paper dollars paper marks to the dollar by over 300 times.
Mm.
You know, and it claimed at the time that this disproved the quantity theory of money.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't actually disprove it. All it does is it tells us that there is another factor involved in that, and that is, if you like, human choice, which, of course, is something that the economics of aggregates does not recognize.
Right.
So what we're going to see, I think, specifically, and it always happens this way, the first sellers of a currency which is inflating are the foreigners. And in America's case, because the dollar is the reserve currency, because everything internationally is priced in dollars, there is a very substantial ownership, foreign ownership of dollars,
yeah.
considerably greater ownership of dollars than ownership of foreign currencies by American residents.
Mm-hmm.
The value of all the securities held by foreigners is in the order of $20.5 trillion.
Wow.
That is just slightly more than current US GDP. On top of that, there's a further $6.3, I think it is, $6 trillion of cash and treasury bills and commercial bills, you know, bills of less than 6 months maturity, in foreign hands. So mm-hmm. total, $27 trillion. Now, that sort of has accumulated really through two factors. Firstly, you have countries and commercial entities exporting to America, doing business with America, seeing their business gradually expand, and so have more dollars, if you like, on a trade-related basis than they would in a more static relationship. So they and that was certainly the case up until 2018, the end of 2018. Mm-hmm. Since then, obviously, international trade has taken a huge, great hit because of the tariff war between America and China.
Right.
So, and the other aspect is that, of course, portfolio investment has meant that the value of bonds and the value of equities held as financial securities has increased quite significantly. Now, with the foreigners having far too many dollars, they've got the liquidity. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of people argue that when you get a crisis, everybody's got to have dollars. No, they have to have liquidity. They got over $6 trillion of liquidity. That is not a problem. But if they begin to take the view, and this was the point about the second article you're referring mm-hmm. to about China's on the dollar, if they take the view the dollar is going to go down, then there's only going to be one thing they do. They will sell it. And the dollar mm-hmm. will fall, and the dollar will fall substantially, and it'll get to a point where it starts affecting the 2% price inflation that the
right.
BLS talks about, and suddenly that will become just not believed at all. Now, it is at that stage that interest rates naturally will rise, and they will rise simply because the time preference between the ownership of goods now and the ownership of goods in the future is increasing because of the loss of purchasing power of the dollar. Mm-hmm. There is only one thing that can happen, and that is that interest rates rise. They will continue to be suppressed, but they'd be suppressed at 5%. They'll be suppressed at 10%. Mm-hmm. And as this spiral continues, possibly they will be suppressed at even higher nominal rates.
Right.
Now, the problem then is, look at what happens to government finances.
Government finances
get completely screwed because already, the interest bill last year was a bit over $400 billion. Now let us assume, well, first of all, we've now got in this current year, we've got a deficit which is running at $3.3 trillion. Next year, I guess it will probably be considerably more. We don't know. We'll see. But it could be easily $5 or $6 trillion. Now, the point is that at $3.3 trillion, the financing of the government deficit is now 50% taxes and 50% inflation.
That's crazy,
So, but from March, you know, this switched over. It switched over, and the bulk of the financing is now through monetary inflation.
Right.
There is no way the dollar can hold up against other currencies while that happens.
Yeah.
To an extent, other currencies have the same problem. But
So as the foreigners walk away from the dollar, and I want to ask you about that with the time we have left, that the Chinese, your article on the Chinese, China is killing the dollar. The foreigners walk away. Somebody's got to buy the treasuries, and a growing number of demand for treasury demand, not demand for treasuries, but borrowing demands from the United States government to finance itself. It's going to grow just out of this world. I mean, it's just, there's no question about it. If you look at the economic situation in the U.S. and globally. So then as that happens, people start to say, wait a minute, the U.S. is printing money. They're hyperinflating essentially. And as you say, time preference. So they have to have higher rates. So this could just really sort of snowball on itself, couldn't it? Really become a snowball.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Fed has the problem that not only will it be funding the U.S. government deficit and raising more than the government raises in taxes, but it will also have to absorb the selling, or someone will have to absorb the selling of U.S. Treasury debt by foreigners, and also the agency debt as well.
Right.
You know, and the importance of that article, the second article, was that China has obviously taken a decision that the one thing that she has got too much of, not copper, not gold, not anything like that, no commodity, but dollars. She's got something like, I mean, we don't know the exact figure, but it will be probably somewhere between 2¾ trillion and 3 trillion of dollars. And that, you know, that is too much. And she's now, I think from that March, do you remember, we've talked about this before.
Yeah, March 23. Yeah, it was March a big, 23rd. Big date. Yeah.
You know, Powell says, whatever it takes. That's in effect what he said. And it was quite clear from that point that from the Chinese angle of holding up to, you know, almost $3 trillion, this is very bad news. They've got to get rid of them. And I think that was the decision that was, I was tipped off by Simon Hunt of Simon Hunt Strategic Services, who follows China immensely closely. He's got such good contacts there. That this is a decision that was taken at about that time. So, you know, I don't believe in coincidence until everything is ruled out. And to my mind, it is not a coincidence. It is, you know, they are related.
Well, you showed in your article, I think you showed the rising prices, at least from the 23rd on, we saw a distinct change in the markets, and the psychology of the markets started to change very dramatically, I would argue, from March 23rd, when Powell gave his whatever it takes speech. And China, according to your article, has been buying a lot of copper. I've read elsewhere as well that they're buying lots of commodities.
Yes.
And so they're really good. So how are they getting rid of the dollar? They're buying commodities. Is that how they're doing it? And then the other thing I want to ask you about with the 3 minutes we have left here is this issue of dumping treasuries. And there is an article that was written in a press that is the Global Times. It's China. It's a state-owned newspaper. Talk just briefly about that and why we might see a really a rapid sale of the dollars by China.
Yes, well, the first thing is that she is selling the dollars for commodities. It's as simple as that. So whoever sells the commodities ends up with the dollars. Then it's not China's problem. As far as the Global Times article is concerned, that was, I think, very surprising because we know that the Chinese have been sort of playing this financial game, if you like, call it a financial war with America, which has been an underlying thing. On that basis, quite simply, I rather lost the thread of where I was going with it. The Global Times. I mean, that article would not have come out without it being sanctioned by central government. It's as simple as that. So the central government is warning, you know, look, unless policies change, whatever those policies might be, they put it into sort of military aggression. But I think it's wider than that. Unless it changes, we're out of the dollar and we're out of your bonds.
Yeah, and unfortunately we're out of time. But I just say that if the Chinese are getting rid of dollars and foreigners are getting dollars and they do that first, it might be a wise thing for Americans to think about doing the same thing, at least to the extent they're able. So I want to thank you so much, Alistair, for sharing your insights, as always. Always a pleasure having you, and it's always so valuable having you. So it's goldmoney.com, folks. Go there every Thursday. I think it's Thursday, right, Alistair? I'll get it right one of these
Correct.
Weeks.
Yes, it is.
Every Thursday, and you're going to write about what this time?
Well, this time I'm looking at history and the German inflation in 1923 and also John Law and the lessons from that.
Excellent. Very good. All right. Well, that's it for this week, folks. Next week, I'm going to have Lynn Alden with me again. Peter Ball of NV Gold is with me and Michael Oliver as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.